This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The New York City Medical Examiner ruled that Jeffrey Epstein's death is a suicide, AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
The 66-year-old financier accused of sex trafficking was found dead in his New York jail cell last Saturday. Now the medical examiner's office has released a statement saying the autopsy and other evidence confirmed Epstein hanged himself at the federal jail. He had been placed on a suicide watch last month after he was found on his cell floor with bruising on his neck, but that watch had been lifted. The attorney general says Epstein's death remains under investigation. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The UN Security Council met privately Friday to discuss the recent escalation of tensions between India and Pakistan following India's August 5th decision to revoke the special status of Jammu and Kashmir. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
After appeals from Pakistan, permanent council member China requested the meeting. Beijing's new UN envoy, Zhang Jun, said afterwards that India's decision has changed the status quo in Kashmir and caused tensions in the region.
China is deeply concerned about the current situation and opposes any unilateral action that complicates the situation.
Kashmir has been a regional flashpoint for decades. Nuclear powers India and Pakistan have fought several wars over the disputed territory since they both gained independence from Britain in 1947. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
U.S. government says it has a warrant to seize an Iranian supertanker caught in diplomatic standoff the coast of British overseas territory, Gibraltar. A court document released Friday by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington shows the court has issued a warrant to seize that vessel. More VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Thousands of travelers at U.S. airports faced delays on Friday because of a nationwide outage of U.S. Customs and Border Protection's processing systems that lasted several hours. In a tweet, CBP said the affected systems are coming back online and travelers are being processed. It said that there was no indication the disruption was malicious in nature. Michael Lillard is a spokesman for the Metropolitan Washington Airport Authority.
Processing procedures are returning to normal. However, passengers arriving at Dulles from international locations may experience a little bit of a lengthier wait time due to the earlier outage.
On an average day, CBP processes around 358,000 air passengers and crew. Democratic Congresswoman from the United States, Rashida Tlaib, now says she will not go to Israel, even after being granted a humanitarian exception. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
Israel gave Tlaib a permit on humanitarian grounds to visit her family, but the Michigan Democrat says she will not accept, citing what she says are oppressive conditions meant to humiliate her and which would break her 90-year-old grandmother's heart. Israel's interior minister earlier said Tlaib made a formal request to visit and had agreed to follow restrictions. Under pressure from President Trump, Israel yesterday took the unprecedented step of saying it would deny Tlaib and fellow lawmaker Ilhan Omar entry to Israel and the West Bank because they back a boycott of the Jewish state. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Easy Rider actor Peter Fonda, the son of Henry Fonda and the brother of Jane Fonda, died Friday at the age of 79 after suffering respiratory failure from lung cancer, his family said in a statement. They also said that it was a deep sorrow that we share the news that Peter Fonda has passed away. He died at his home in Los Angeles Friday morning, according to the statement. It also said that in honor of Peter, please raise a glass to freedom, it added. A 23-year-old man has been charged on Friday with the murder of an Australian tourist in New Zealand's coastal town of Raglan on the North Island, according to police. The arrest followed a manhunt for the suspect after the 33-year-old victim was found shot dead in a camper van in Raglan. A Canadian woman who had been traveling with the victim was able to escape. The police identified the victim on Saturday, and before the shootings at two mosques that killed 51 people in March, New Zealand was considered one of the safest countries, with the homicide rate a third the average recorded among member countries in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, our periodic update on Africa. We focus on Liberia in the west and Mozambique in the southeast. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Liberia has long been riddled with violence and economic dependence on foreign aid. Its deep-seated issues, coupled with recent economic and political turbulence, threaten to undermine a fragile peace. 1 year after the departure of the United Nations mission in Liberia, UNMIL, Liberian security prospects are increasingly uncertain. UNMIL's withdrawal and the simultaneous transition from President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to George Weah in 2018 occurred in an orderly and peaceful manner. However, Liberia is now facing an economic downturn and mounting political tensions that are seriously affecting the living standards of Liberians. On June 7, thousands of demonstrators took to the streets of the capital, Monrovia, to submit a petition to the government. Their list of grievances was drafted by a group of civil society representatives called the Council of Patriots. The document lists several short and long-term measures to address perceived corruption and economic stagnation. In Mozambique, there's turmoil in the northern coastal province of Cabo Delgado, linked to gas discovery and exploration. Northern Mozambique is now home to one of the world's largest natural gas deposits. Exactly 1 year ago, so-called Islamist militants attacked more than a dozen villages along Mozambique's northern coastal region. The militants said they want to replace the elected government of Mozambique with institutions based on Sharia law. The violence affected work in the region's Rovuma Basin, where energy giants like ExxonMobil and Anadarko Petroleum are investing some $50 billion, or four times Mozambique's gross domestic product. Anadarko Petroleum is developing a $15 billion liquefied natural gas project in the region. The little-known militia that claimed responsibility for the attacks last year is called Ansar al-Sunna. It formed about 4 years ago when several hundred unemployed youths began organizing into cells. While a majority of the population in Mozambique is Christian, half of the northern region's 2.3 million people are Muslim, and attacks have mainly targeted Christians. The group has allegedly established links to Islamist militias in Somalia, Tanzania, Kenya, and the Great Lakes region. Well, despite the links to Islamist militias, local leaders and analysts say the attacks are overwhelmingly a local phenomenon stemming from an explosive mix of ethnic and religious tensions in deep poverty. Well, in addition, we'll be discussing the recently signed peace accord between President Philippe Nyusi and the leader of RENAMO rebel group, Osufe Momade. We'll also preview elections slated to take place on October 15. For the first time, Mozambicans will be voting directly for governors, which have heretofore been appointed by the central government. Well, with us to analyze the deteriorating political and social conditions in Liberia, as well as the turmoil in northern Mozambique, are Judd Devermont. He's the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and that's a Washington-based policy group, and Joshua Meservey. He's senior policy analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation, a think tank also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, Judd Devermont, let me start with you about Liberia. Talk about the roots of this economic and political turmoil.
I think this is a case of unrealistic expectations, amateurish governance, and political cynicism. When Ellen Johnson Sirleaf left power and George Weah was elected, there was some enthusiasm for his candidacy. He was not of the American Liberian class. He was a famed soccer star, and Liberians wanted something different. He ended up cobbling together an interesting coalition, including Charles Taylor's ex-wife, some of Charles Taylor's and other rebel groups' leaders, but also a tacit nod from Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. But he came in unprepared. And I think we have seen over the past year plus real mismanagement of the economy, scandals over currency, missing millions of dollars. And what's happened is the opposition and civil society have taken advantage of Weah's mistakes, and they have organized multiple times, including the June 7th protest and then a smaller protest just in late July.
Turning to you, Joshua Meservey, to add or subtract to the roots of what we're seeing both politically and economically,
Some analysts have said that perhaps the current crisis has to do with the way UNMIL withdrew. They didn't prepare the country for the loss of aid dollars. How would you see the roots of what's going on?
Yeah, I think the withdrawal of UNMIL is at best sort of a peripheral issue. I think the real core issues, Judd touched on them. This is a governance issue. George Weah has been a disappointment, frankly. There was great hope around him. He was untainted in many people's eyes. Liberia, unfortunately, has a long history of corrupt governance, and there was the hope that he could move Liberia beyond that epoch in Liberia's history. I would actually go even further back, though, and talk about the Civil War. They fought a horrific civil war in this country that killed maybe a tenth of the population. And the legacy lives on. It did not end that long ago, and it devastated the country, obviously, economically. Infrastructure was destroyed, what little there was. And I think people are still carrying around the political scars, so to speak, and others, no doubt. So you still have people in the Senate, for instance, who were warlords during that time. And Judd mentioned that Charles Taylor's wife is still very involved politically, as were some of Charles Taylor's other cronies. So the legacy of the war is still very relevant here. And unfortunately, there hasn't been the type of leadership that can unite the country, move it beyond this really poor governance that is sort of a wound on top of an existing wound.
Turning back to you, Judd Devermont, add or subtract to how you see the ramifications of the civil war still playing out in Liberia. And does the international community bear any responsibility? Did they abandon the country too soon or not provide the proper economic assistance or technical advice and political advice, let's say, to be self-sufficient?
I think this has been an issue, as Josh said, of governance. I think it's been the politicization of identity politics. It's a country where the government is seen as the key employer, key source of revenue and resources. And so I don't know if I would put this on the doorsteps of the international community. I would say that UNMIL had been around for a decade plus. It was probably time to transition it. What Liberia faces now is not security problems, but economic challenges. The IMF just weighed in on its growth. They're down to under 1%, 0.4% growth for this year, down from 4%. And so the international community can do a number of things, but that's really about engaging any sort of support for budget, for good governance, working with George Weah to reduce his dependency on people who have not Liberia's best interests at heart.
Turning back to you, Joshua, what are the main sources of revenue for Liberia?
This is part of the challenge. It's a very commodities-dependent economy. And, of course, we've had a commodity slump for a number of years. And this is a challenge that plagues a lot of African countries. And there's a real need to diversify the economy in that country away from iron ore and rubber and cocoa. And hand in hand with that is, again, what Judd mentioned, moving away from reliance on aid. So that, yet again, back to the theme, is going to require some responsible and visionary governance and some support from the international community, technical support, working with the ministries maybe to harmonize and rationalize their regulations. There's all sorts of low-hanging fruit in many ways in the regulatory sphere where they could make that a little more attractive for investors and make it a little bit easier for their entrepreneurs to start businesses, things of that nature. There's no quick fix. There's no silver bullet here. This is going to be a very hard, very long, very slow process, unfortunately.
Well, speaking of governance, has there been a response from the government regarding the Council of Patriots' grievances?
I'm not aware of a robust response to it. It seems like the government is trying to slow them down, do some pro forma responses, but it's going to be difficult for the government to actually tackle what the Patriots are raising. There's some political cynicism behind the Patriots, whether it's Charles Brumskin or Alex Cummings or former Vice President Boakai. I mean, most of the opposition have coalesced together to take down George Weah. So I think that the government should look at the challenges as challenges outside of what the Patriots raise or do not raise, because that will be the pathway to success. Liberia's success hangs with how the rest of the region is doing. Sierra Leone and Guinea and Liberia's successes are tied together. When they are in conflict, they all three are in conflict, or at least under pressure from it, are strained. When there's Ebola outbreaks, it affects all three of those countries. And right now, if you look at the broader region, I think that they have fallen short on some of the regional integration opportunities they had in terms of moving commodities across rail, which could help lift all the countries. Both Sierra Leone and Guinea are also politically pretty vulnerable right now. So I think we need to focus on Liberia's problems for Liberia's problems, but think about some of the solutions are much broader. It's about this region, the Mana River region, working together well.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Judd Devermont, Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Joshua Mazurvi. He's Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. We've been analyzing the deteriorating political and social and economic conditions in Liberia, and we will be soon turning our attention to Mozambique. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Monrovia, Liberia, Ambona Mkepi. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, let's turn now to Mozambique. Judd, let's start with the so-called peace accord that was signed between the president and the opposition rebel leader of RENAMO. And I'm going to just say, full disclosure, I was with ONUMAS, the UN peacekeeping force, all the way back in 1993. And it was seen as a success at that point. And here we are in 2019. They're signing another one. What's going on?
Let me start with some framing. I think that Mozambique is at a crossroads more than any time since the end of the Civil War. Carol, when you were there in the 90s, some really important decisions will take place in the next couple of years that are going to shape the trajectory of this country. With respect to the peace deal, this is the third peace deal between RENAMO and FRELIMO since the Civil War started in 1977. We saw an outbreak of the long two-decade-plus peace in 2013 when RENAMO started attacking in Central District, and then leader of RENAMO, Afonso Del Clama, moved back to Gorongosa. Then just ahead of the elections in 2014, there was an agreement between the president at that time, Gabuza, and Lakama. They had elections. And then after elections, RENAMO goes back to the bush and more fighting. And this current president, Nyusi, and Lakama, and then when Del Clama passed away, his successor, Mamade, have worked out this agreement, which is at its core, how do we share Mozambique's future together? I think that's what really animated Del Clama, a view that he was, his share of votes was shrinking and LNG was going to come online, and he didn't think that RENAMO supporters were going to get their share. And so one of the ways in which this deal is unique is that this time, through indirect elections, RENAMO will win governorships. There'll be direct elections, and then if your party wins the highest percentage in your region, you will get the governorship. And that will hopefully give them some share of the wealth. One wrinkle is that in response, the government is going to name secretaries of state in each of the districts. And so there is a big question. First, how many governorships does RENAMO win? And second, what is the actual authorities of the governors versus the secretary of states?
Turning to you, Joshua Mazurvi, with respect to this peace accord, the elections. I mean, I remember that at the time, Mozambique was seen as somewhat of a success, especially vis-a-vis Angola. But now that Mozambique has gas resources, we're seeing the same competition for resources between RENAMO and FRELIMO. Again, FRELIMO has this history of governing primarily in the south and not really taking care of the northern provinces. And now we have the gas coming online in Cabo Delgado, and we have this insurgency. So what is your take on, you know, what's happening and what the prospects are?
The gas find is immense. It's one of the largest discovered in recent memory. And it obviously has the potential to transform the country in a very positive way. There is always a downside, or can be a serious downside, to these big resource finds. There's a very popular concept known as the resource curse, which, because when governments are reliant on the revenues from extractive industries, they're perceived to be, and often are, less responsive to their constituents. They have this almost bulletproof revenue stream, so they don't have to respond to their constituents, as I say, over-reliant on that revenue stream. And then there's Dutch disease, which all your other exports become more expensive because you're exporting so much of the resource. So this is, I'm nervous, frankly, for Mozambique. This could be a wonderful thing, truly, but it will have to be properly managed in a transparent and honest and fair way. We haven't always seen that from the Mozambican government. And then you do have this insurgency that you referenced in the north and sometimes called Al-Shabaab, no relation to the Somalia Al-Shabaab, but a group. It seems like it's a decentralized group of cells of young people who probably started out as street hawkers. There's a lot of opacity around this. We don't know exactly who these guys are, but they clearly have an Islamist bent, but they're also in bed with some of the organized crime networks up there. That's how they get some of their revenues, and they may even have some networks across the borders. Borders very porous in that part of Mozambique. So that complicates the natural gas issue because the security services have responded with a very heavy hand at times, and even to the point of shelling a village. They had gunboats and a helicopter, I believe, shell a village, sort of the consummate indiscriminate response. And that will only inflame what's going on up there. So the government is under a lot of pressure to pacify this area because of the gas, but they have to do it in a much wiser, fairer way.
Judd Evermont, why don't you give us your take on this insurgency? What are some of the root causes, the drivers of this extremism?
This is what I would call an insipid insurgency. That's important because it means that there are opportunities here in the embryonic stage to address its concerns, snuff it out, and bring back some of these individuals as part of society. But the group started, at least we know, back into the beginning of this decade as a hijra group, Islamists in bent looking to practice their religion, and the establishment Islamic groups, the Islamic Council and the Islamic Congress, were vehemently opposed to them and got the government to push them out of villages and then have some of the leaders arrested. And so that's when we saw on October 5th, 2017, this coordinated attack to free their leaders. What's difficult to understand about this group, as Josh said, they haven't made almost any public pronouncements at all. We don't really know what their objectives are. In fact, most of their objectives we're hearing from interlocutors that I would call untrustworthy. So whether it's ISIS claiming to speak for them or the government claiming to speak to them. We did some research recently looking at the attack structure. So you saw a number of attacks in 2018 really push out from the coastal region. There are three major ethnic groups in Cabo Delgado, the Mwani on the coast, the Makande, which is Nusi's ethnic group in the north, and then the Macau, which are in the central district in the most populous part of the country. And so in 2018, you saw this group, which is largely Mwani, really push into the Makande and the Macau areas. And this year, the attacks have actually moved back to the coast, along the main streets and on the coast. So it raises really interesting questions about their reach, constraints on their growth, and whether their message is popular. They largely are attacking their own villages and communities, probably for strategic reasons to consolidate control. And so that should bring us all back to the fact that this is a group that is animated by generational tensions, by economic grievances, by feelings of political exclusion. And if the government stops making mistakes, as Josh pointed out, attacking them the way they attacked Renamo, I think they could actually make a lot of progress against them. But they're pushing people into the group through their indiscriminate and violent tactics.
Well, turning to you, Joshua, quickly, do you know if there are any ties to some of the larger Islamist groups that like to take credit, like ISIS, or to what extent do we know of any links?
To my knowledge, we haven't seen any links with ISIS or any of the other major terrorist groups. There is no doubt that there has been some cross-border movement. So there are rumors that some of their fighters have been trained in Somalia, for instance, which probably means they trained with Al-Shabaab. Again, it's all very murky, though. It's hard to really nail it down. I wouldn't at all be surprised if these links do exist, just given the nature of that region and the porous nature of the borders. I'm sure it does, but I haven't seen anything operational
right between
Al-Shabaab and the northern Mozambicans.
Well, back to you, Judd Evermont. A lot of this could be averted as well as tamped down if elections go forward and more decentralization of power is allowed. Talk about the elections coming up, what's at stake and what the issues are, and do you think that they are going to change their approach to the North and reduce this kind of heavy-handed security and allow for greater local governance, especially over this very resource-rich region.
President Nyusi is actually from this area. He's Makonde, so it's his ethnic group that sits on the border with Tanzania. Largely, he said the right things about how to address this problem set. His command and control over the security services, in my mind, seems uncertain. They're the ones who are carrying out some of the worst acts of violence. And so I would say there's a couple of things that have to happen. First, Nyusi has to make sure there's much more cohesion and discipline within his security forces in terms of the way they treat it. This needs to be a law enforcement and intelligence operation in conjunction with the region to address sort of the worst elements of this group. I think there needs to be a way in which the oil companies and all of the other private sector work to employ local Cabo Delgados and make sure the perception that the economic benefits hit all. And finally, I think there has to be some thinking about what is Islam in Cabo Delgado. Some of the things that this group wants to do in terms of practicing their faith the way they want it, I don't think that that's necessarily in opposition to a pluralistic society as Mozambique. And so there's going to be some accommodations there as well. But I think if you went holistically, economic, political, security, and I think have some space for different faith practices, we could get out of this. Because again, it's not even been 3 years. We're in a very early stage of this insurgency.
You get the last word, Joshua. I'd like you to specifically address the role of the oil and gas companies in being constructive at this point, and to what extent are they being constructive, or are they perhaps exacerbating the problem?
The locals will have to see some benefits from these massive projects. They understand this is an extraordinary lucrative find. So the oil companies are aware of these dynamics as well. Anadarko actually had a convoy get attacked, and they suspended their operations because of it in the north. They're back now. I don't doubt they're committed to trying to hire as many locals as possible. There's a lot of corporate social responsibility activities that hopefully they'll undertake that might ameliorate some of these sort of environmental elements that are fueling the insurgency. But to Judd's point about, you know, the role of Islam here, it does appear to be there's like a hardcore element that is Islamist within this insurgency, and they're not going to be dissuaded by jobs or anything like that. They have to be dealt with, unfortunately, by the security services, who need to do a much better job. They need to be more disciplined, more cohesive, as Judd mentioned.
Quickly, one more question, gentlemen. U.S. Prosper Africa Initiative. There was a conference in Mozambique. It was organized by the Corporate Council on Africa. Talk about, Judd, the outcome of this. The U.S. Deputy Secretary of Commerce was there, and I know for years, again, in my work with Africa, we've been trying to get more trade and less aid. Are we going in that direction?
I think this is a good start, but there's lots more to do. So the goal is to double two-way trade between the United States and Africa. And what they announced in Maputo was addressing a long-standing problem, which is the U.S. government is really difficult to work with if you are a private sector company. You are on this endless scavenger hunt to get all of the different Easter eggs that open up, credits, insurance. My view is that that's basic. That's what we should be doing. I'm glad we've gotten it done. But to really unlock these economies, we have to do a lot more storytelling to the American private sector about the benefits of Africa. And we have to do a lot more work with African governments to change the enabling environment. So a coordination mechanism, which is essentially what Prosper Africa is one of the facets to really unlock trade. But it's necessary but not sufficient.
Well, now you really do get the last word, Joshua, on this U.S. Prosper Africa initiative. We are, that is the United States, a natural partner. We're not one of the former colonial powers. There is, from my experience in managing scholarship programs and working in Africa, that there is just a natural interest on the part of Africans to work directly with the United States. Why are we not capitalizing sufficiently on that?
Yeah, there's a host of reasons. One is we have to demystify the continent for the American private sector. There are many American companies that are doing work in Africa and are very adept at it and comfortable. But there's also many that would just never consider Africa because they immediately think of corruption or violence or whatever it is. And yes, that exists on parts of the continent. You have to take it into account. But there's also extraordinary potential there and opportunities. And there are American companies making a lot of money. And so, you have to demystify it. You have to get the U.S. government more involved in helping any American company that is interested do what what the U.S. government can do to facilitate their entry into or their expansion in Africa. And then, yeah, the regulatory environments in a lot of these countries are very frustrating and complex. So there's low-hanging fruit there that these countries need to deal with, and hopefully the U.S. government can sort of double down on helping them with on that side of the ledger as well.
That's all the time we have on this particular edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Judd Devermont, Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Joshua Meservey, Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Jonah Cummings. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America. Thank you.